You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
Both Madeline Miller and Zachary Mason's work causes to think about the mythic characters Achilles and Odysseus in a modern and often psychological way. Madeline Miller's debut novel, The Song of Achilles, takes lyric flight from the Iliad's first line, "Sing, goddess of the terrible rage of Achilles." She focuses on the relationship between the half-god warrior Achilles and his friend and lover Patrocles, bringing them both to life with skill and daring, combining scholarship with imagination. And in Zachary Mason's novel, the Odyssey is turned inside out and upside down, and yet the images cohere. As one observer pointed out on Slate, quote, "The effect of reading the lost books is to make you realize that it's not just its narrative of homecoming that makes the Odyssey so archetypal. It's also that the poem captures the irrepressible human impulse to tell stories, and perhaps to favor a good story over a strictly accurate one." Madeline Miller hails from the East Coast, earning her undergraduate and graduate degrees in classics from Brown. For the last 10 years, she's been teaching and tutoring Latin, Greek, and Shakespeare to high school students. The Song of Achilles was awarded the 2012 Orange Prize for Fiction and was a New York Times bestseller, as has been translated into 23 languages, including Greek, which I think is great. Zachary Mason is a novelist and also a computer scientist. He grew up in Silicon Valley, attended Bard College, and received his PhD from Brandeis, where his thesis is titled, quote, "A Computational Corpus-Based Metaphor Extraction System." I leave that to your imagination. The Lost Books of the Odyssey was a finalist for the 2008 New York Public Library Young Lions Fiction Award. And this is the first time I'm very happy to note that Zachary and Madeline will be sharing a stage, and also to note that they each have a myth that they have retold as a contribution to Penguin Books' book Orpheus, 50 New Myths. And I had the great pleasure of being on an author's panel last spring, which Molly Polda moderated at USC. She is Provost Postdoc Scholar in the Humanities at USC and is currently working on a manuscript about secrecy in contemporary literature and culture. Please welcome Madeline Miller, Zachary Mason, and Molly Polda. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ken and Louise, for the wonderful introduction. Thank you all for coming. I know it's hot as Hades out there, so it's nice to be here in the air conditioning with all of you. In ancient Greece, Homer and other storytellers recited their tales from memory. But let's allow our authors to read from their passages rather than from memory. So please, whoever would like to go first.
Go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to read two very brief sections. The first section is when Achilles and Patroclus are quite young, still boys. Patroclus has been exiled from his kingdom for accidentally killing another boy, and he has been taken in by Achilles and Achilles' father as sort of a charity case. So this section is the beginning of their friendship when they're about 11 years old. The second section I'm going to read, also very short, is the first time that Patroclus meets Achilles' sea nymph mother, whose name is Thetis. Our friendship came all at once after that, like spring floods from the mountains. Before, the boys and I had imagined that his days were filled with princely instruction, statecraft, and spear. But I had long since learned the truth. Other than his lyre lessons and his drills, he had no instruction. One day we might go swimming, another we might climb trees. We made up games for ourselves of racing and tumbling. We would lie on the warm sand and say, guess what I'm thinking about? The falcon we had seen from our window, the boy with the crooked front tooth, dinner, And as we swam or played or talked, a feeling would come. It was almost like fear in the way it filled me, rising in my chest. It was almost like tears in how swiftly it came. But it was neither of those, buoyant where they were heavy and bright where they were dull. I had known contentment before, brief snatches of time in which I pursued solitary pleasure, skipping stones or dicing or dreaming. But in truth, it had been less a presence than an absence, a laying aside of dread. My father was not near, nor boys. I was not hungry, nor tired, nor sick. This feeling was different. I found myself grinning until my cheeks hurt, my scalp prickling till I thought it might lift off my head. My tongue ran away from me, giddy with freedom. "This and this and this," I said to him. I did not have to fear that I spoke too much. I did not have to worry that I was too slender or too slow. "This and this and this." I taught him how to skip stones, and he taught me how to carve wood. I could feel every nerve in my body, every brush of air against my skin. He played my mother's lyre, and I watched. When it was my turn to play, my fingers tangled in the strings, and the teacher despaired of me. I did not care. "Play again," I told him, and he played until I could barely see his fingers in the dark. I saw then how I had changed. I did not mind anymore that I lost when we raced, and I lost when we swam out to the rocks, and I lost when we tossed spears or skipped stones. For who can be ashamed to lose to such beauty? It was enough to watch him win, to see the soles of his feet flashing as they kicked up sand, or the rise and fall of his shoulders as he pulled through the salt. It was enough. The next night, when the household slept, I climbed out of our window. The moon was half full, bright enough for me to pick my way over the rocks without a torch. He had said that I was to stand in the surf and she would come. "No," he had reassured me, "you do not need to speak. She will know." The waves were warm and thick with sand. I shifted, watched the small white crabs run through the surf. I was listening, thinking I might hear the splash of her feet as she approached. A breeze blew down the beach, and grateful, I closed my eyes to it. When I opened them again, she was standing before me. She was taller than I was, taller than any woman I had ever seen. Her black hair was loosed on her back, and her skin shone luminous and impossibly pale, as if it drank light from the moon. She was so close I could smell her, seawater laced with dark brown honey. I did not breathe. I did not dare. "You are Patroclus." I flinched at the sound of her voice, hoarse and rasping. I had expected chimes, not the grinding of rocks in the surf. "Yes, lady." Distaste ran over her face. Her eyes were not like a human's. They were black to their center and flecked with gold. I could not bring myself to meet them. "He will be a god," she said. I did not know what to say, so I said nothing. She leaned forward, and I half thought she might touch me, but of course she did not. "Do you understand?" I could feel her breath on my cheek, not warm at all, but chilled like the depths of the sea. "Do you understand?" He had told me, too, that she hated to be kept waiting. "Yes." She leaned closer still, looming over me. Her mouth was a gash of red, like the torn open stomach of a sacrifice, bloody and oracular. Behind it, her teeth shone sharp and white as bone. "Good." Carelessly, as if to herself, she added, "You will be dead soon enough." She turned and dove into the sea, leaving no ripples behind her.
I'm going to read three short sections from my book. They don't lend themselves to much preface, so I'll just go in. Ironically, this is the preface. Despite its complexity, a handful of images are central to the Odyssey. Black ships drawn up on a white beach, a cannibal ogre guarding a cave mouth, a man searching a trackless sea for a home that forgot him. Nearly three millennia ago, a particular ordering of these images crystallized into the Odyssey as we know it. But before that, the Homeric material was formless, fluid, its elements shuffled into new narratives like cards in a deck. Echoes of the other Odysseys survive in Hellenistic friezes, on Cycladic funerary urns, and in a pre-Ptolemaic papyrus excavated from the desiccated rubbish mounds of Oxyrhynchus. This last contains 44 concise variations on Odysseus's story that omit stock epic formulae in favor of honing a single trope or image down to an extreme of clarity. I hope that this translation reflects the haunted light of Homer's older islands, where the familiar characters are arranged in new tableaus, but soon become restless, mercurial. They turn their backs, forget their names, move on. And this is chapter 14, which is not perhaps entirely chapter length. It's called Fragment. A single fragment is all that survives for the 45th book of the Odyssey. Odysseus, finding that his reputation for trickery preceded him, started inventing histories for himself and disseminating them wherever he went. This had the intended effect of clouding perception and distorting expectation, making it easier for him to work as he was wont, and the unexpected effect that one of his lies became, with minor variations, the Odyssey of Homer. And this is the last one, chapter 24, Odysseus in Hell. A man picks his way along a steel cable strung over a refulgent blue abyss, a ship soar over his shoulders for balance. The cable groans and sighs in the infinitesimal breeze. It is so narrow that the man is, when he thinks of it, surprised he is able to keep his footing. Miles in front of him, the horizon is shrouded in bright clouds. It may well be the same behind him, but he has never looked back. The cable sags, very slightly, just discernibly, over the course of what may be hours or days. He is descending. Above him, he sees this out of his peripheral vision, to look up would be fatal, is an irregular dark massiveness suggesting mountains. There are iridescent patches that could be lakes or possibly cities. Below is open sky, gradations of deep, featureless blue. Now a weariness comes over him, and he stops to rest, squatting and balancing the oar across his shoulders, gripping the cable with his feet and hands, peering down into the void in which he finds a measure of comfort. He has been walking and balancing for a long time, and his mind wanders. For the most part, his reflections are vacant or circular recapitulations of the conditions of his confinement in this limitless open air. When a thought crystallizes, it is this. Somewhere, a judgment is being made. Even now, advocates are striding in flapping robes through bleak arcades toward the anterooms, where they will make their case before a judge, whose name he almost knows, Minos, or possibly Yama. This stirs something in his arid, empty mind. He wants to argue the case himself. He knows that if the judgment goes against him, a wind will rise in the west, a white rushing mass devouring a hemisphere of sky, racing over him, scouring the cable clean. He considers tactics for such a situation, leaning into the wind and walking on the windward side of the cable, or breaking into a dead run when he sees the storm rising, with every hasty step risking a sudden final slip, though no end to the cable is in view. He recognizes the futility of these plans, but this does not permit him to stop formulating them. The cable might be getting narrower. His legs might be weakening. He might feel the air stirring. Eyes closed, he hesitates and imagines the languor of falling. He sees himself snatching futilely at the cable, missing, how quickly it would dwindle, and how he would at last have the luxury of looking up at the world he was following away from, secure in the knowledge that whatever else came, the worst had happened. He steadies himself and takes another step. Once a generation, the springtide reaches the broken walls of Troy, and it is granted him to recall that once he was Odysseus.
Wonderful. Thank you both so much. How many of us are familiar with the Odyssey, have read it or parts of it? Oh, wow. Okay, great. Almost total participation. Excellent. So, as you know, Homer is one of the fathers of Western literature, which makes me wonder if it might have taken a little bit of hubris to rewrite Homer in any way. Did you approach your project with excitement, with trepidation? How did you feel taking on the big guy?
I didn't think that it required hubris. Everybody's been rewriting Homer through recorded history. From Euripides to Margaret Atwood, for that matter, there's good reason to believe, although this is, I guess, a contentious subject if you're a classical scholar, which I'm not, so it's not contentious for me, that Homer was incorporating lots of found narrative himself. And in any case, it was an oral tradition initially, so he was rewriting himself continually. So Homer seems like a history of rewriting. Hmm. Sure. Could somebody turn up the volume? That's probably a more practical solution. Anyway.
I did feel a fear of hubris doing this sort of thing. You know, coming from a classical background, you're constantly thinking about, you know, Icarus plummeting from the sky and all sorts of, you know, being devoured by your own dogs. That's not really a case of hubris, but, you know, you get the point. There's not a lot of understanding for stepping where you're not supposed to step. So for a long time, actually, when I was working on this, I didn't tell anyone I was doing it. I didn't tell my professors. I didn't tell my peers in graduate school. I didn't tell anybody. Because I thought, well, it's just that Achilles thing I'm working on, and if I finish it, maybe then. So when I finally had my galley complete in front of me, that was when I sent it to my professors. And I said, so there's this thing I've been writing for the last 10 years. Here it is. And then I sort of waited like a little bit like that. The truth is that actually my professors were incredibly generous about it and really welcoming for exactly the reason that you pointed out, which is I think that Homer has been told and retold and retold, so it's not a new thing to retell him. And that is also how he has lived, is that people keep coming to these stories because people retell them. And I think that is always a wonderful thing, however people can enter into the stories.
But why? Why have so many people taken on Homer again and again? What is it about these stories that's so endlessly adaptable?
I have no really good answer, but I have a few guesses.
Guess so, away.
So part of it is just its longevity, much like Angeline. It's famous for being famous. I mean, it's famous for many other things too. But it's so entrenched that even if you've never gotten around to reading the Iliad and the Odyssey, if you've read some, then you probably know basically what happens and what's going on. It feels like a cornerstone. And I also feel like in some way it's a prime of literature by analogy with the prime numbers, although I'd be hard-pressed to really justify that point of view.
Mm. I like that. I'm gonna quote you on that. I think it is the characters and the stories are so incredibly vivid and true to human experience. I think Homer really understands, and the ancient Greeks in general really understood all the facets of human experience. And so when you read the Iliad or you read the Odyssey, I think all those human emotions shine through, you know, what it's like to lose a spouse or to fear losing a spouse, grief, love, pride, rage, all these human emotions are timeless, and I think Homer just nails them. And so when you read it, you're not looking at this thing that's, you know, centuries, millennia old. You're looking at something that is new and that speaks to us and our moment now.
I feel like your two answers are a great introduction to each of your books. We have the human element with Madeline's very warm, emotionally engaging, yet completely gripping book. And we have some prime numbers of a thought experiment of rearranging potential ways of looking at the Odyssey.
And Angeline.
And, oh, yes. But of course. And Zachary mentioned that you know how it ends already. I know there are some Trojans in the audience. Can I see my Trojans for a second? Some USC folks? Okay, so you guys know that we lost the war, right? The Greeks won. So that's awkward. But so anyone who reads the Iliad or the Odyssey knows how it ends, and people who come to your books know how the original ends. So how did you take on this task of rewriting a story with a predetermined ending? Maybe we should start with you, Madeline.
Well, first of all, Trojans, just so you know, you all become the Romans and then you defeat the Greeks, so you do get your revenge.
Don't forget the Britons.
That's right, and the Britons. So it's amazing how many traditions were trying to trace their origins back to the Iliad, back to that Trojan War. I'm sorry, say that one more time.
What was it like to write a story that was inspired by something with a predetermined ending?
Yes. Well, this is where I also have a background in theater, which I was very grateful for in terms of this, because if you are a theater director and you are directing Hamlet or King Lear or one of the classics, people come, they know how it ends, you know how it ends. There is no, you know, spoiler alert. But you can still tell it in a way that hopefully brings new life to it, that brings something new, that really draws out the arc, that makes the characters pop, something. And, you know, that's your job as a director, is to tell the story that people probably already know very well and find something new in it. So I really went to that as my inspiration.
So I've read my favorite books, in some cases, hundreds of times, so I'm not that motivated by a shock ending. And also, in my book, it ends differently in lots of different ways.
That is very true. That is true. So Madeline mentioned her background as a theater director. She's also a classicist. And yet, Zachary here is a computer scientist. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us a little bit about how those worlds work together?
That's a good question. I'm curious about that myself. I have no really clear understanding. So more than a computer scientist, I actually study artificial intelligence. So that's about as humanistic as you can get within the hard sciences. I don't know if that actually sheds any light on the question. So I'm also particularly interested in the formal computational character of language, which couldn't conceivably really inform the writing process because, it's like the difference between particle physics and engineering. It's sort of the same stuff, but the scale is radically different, and you can't really consider one in terms of the other. So I have no idea. One thing. There's a literary movement, or rather there was, called Oulipo, which is a French acronym-ish thing that basically means what potential works of literature. It was this weird 70s sort of hybrid thing, which was supposed to partake of both literature and mathematics. So basically it was building literature around mathematical skeletons. And there were some absolutely brilliant things like Italo Calvino's Invisible Cities and some interesting things like Kuno's Exercises in Style and a lot of monstrosities. But anyway, I always sort of was drawn to that since it spoke to both halves of my mind. And originally, The Lost Books was supposed to be a sort of more overtly Oulipan exercise, although that dissolved at some point.
Inevitably, right? It inevitably dissolved. I mean, do you feel like that's possible to have a?
So the actual Oulipans did it with varying degrees of success, but certainly they respected the formalisms they had concocted for themselves. I concocted formalisms, played with them, then got bored and put them aside. But you can still sort of see the initial project in various bits and pieces. That actually happened a lot. Like, I would build up an idea for a book and then burn it down and take the ashes and make another thing and burn that down and so on. So it's a highly composite kind of thing.
Well, the playfulness definitely survives. I mean, I didn't really taste ashes as I was reading it. It was more joyful than that.
Oh, good. I think the playfulness is kind of in the destruction and reconstruction and redestruction and so on.
That makes sense. The burning of Troy over and over again. it's all cyclical. That makes some sense. Let's see. Okay, so here's a question about writing. What was it like to immerse yourself in another time period? How did you sit down at the computer and transport yourself to ancient Greece? Were there any rituals? Was there any toga action going on? Did you drink mead? How did you get yourself in the spirit?
I'm not denying there was a Dionysian bacchanal, but NDAs were signed.
Yeah, there's so many wonderful rituals that come out of the classical world, you know, sacrificing goats. I did not do any of that.
Not yet.
We'll see how the next book is going. I think that, well, for one thing, writing about Homer is a little bit tricky because Homer himself is not historical. You know, the time period that is assigned to the Trojan War is actually 500 years before the composing of the Iliad and the Odyssey. And so you can even see in the Iliad and the Odyssey these interesting anachronisms. And of course, Homer himself, if it was even one man composing all this, which, as you said, you know, there's a lot of doubt about that. It seems like it's coming from a lot of different places to create these poems. That he was composing them without the use of any sort of library, without the use of any sort of research materials. And so, you know, he was just guessing, drawing on years and years of oral tradition. And so they're really mythological works. You can't go to them for history. And so if you're going to write in Homer's world, I think you have to make the decision that you are going to try and locate it in a historical time period. You're going to have to try and go back to actual Bronze Age Mycenaean Greece and dig there, knowing that then you're sort of leaving Homer behind. Or just embrace Homer and all his messy anachronism, and all his, you know, divinities and monsters, and accept that it is not historical, that it is something else, that it's a poetic world and a literary world. So I think part of my ritual was letting go of the history and being willing to live in an entirely literarily constructed world.
So I, besides the bacchanals, I never really tried to keep any sense of historical integrity. Like, I saw it as a sort of dream time to begin with. So, for instance, the bits about ships have more to do with the 19th century English Royal Navy than a way anyone would actually construct or sail a ship in ancient Greece. And there are all kinds of things like that. One of the things I think is fun about the book is that, well, there's this sort of frame in the footnotes where someone, the author, I guess, is speaking with an air of great authority, and you can imagine him champing his pipe in his wood-paneled office and so forth. But actually, the entire thing is deliberately rife with inaccuracies.
Huh. Madeline, did you catch these? I know that you're a fan of the book, so I'm curious, since you are the classicist on stage here, and we are the two imitators, could you feel those inaccuracies, as he calls them, but I would just call, you know, playful riffs. How did you react as a reader?
Oh, well, absolutely, playful riffs. I mean, it was so clearly done intentionally and in the spirit of Odysseus himself, I think.
Should you tell us a little bit about your author's note, as we were discussing a moment ago?
Sure. So, all better? Good, okay. So there are two editions of the book. This one, which some of you have, is the second one. The first one came out with a small press. There are about 500 copies floating around in the world. There are another 500 in my basement. Anyway, so there, it's the super extended bonus edition of the book. There are two extra stories. There's an introduction and an appendix that are surprisingly long, like 20 pages apiece. There's also an author's note. So I've never liked author bios. It seems like they're always sort of trivial, and they're either sort of humiliating in the author's lack of achievement or irritating in the author's crushing achievement. It didn't seem like a winnable contest. So I made it up. There was a frame story anyway where a fictionalized version of me had discovered these manuscripts and was translating them and so on. So I kept the author bio in that frame. And it was written to convey an air of great authority and be superficially plausible. But actually, the entire thing is a lie, and it's obvious if you spend 5 seconds on Google. Like I claim to be the John Shade professor of thus and such at Magdalen College. John Shade was a character in a metafictional Nabokov novel, and Magdalen College is a place I'd never seen at the time, where my boss, who I liked, went. So people still try to contact me through Magdalen from time to time.
That's amazing.
My next author bio, I'm going to do that.
Excellent.
I look forward to seeing it. I really do.
You should apply for the Shade Chair. I think they'd...
I hope it might be free.
Yeah, I hope that they would accept me.
I think this is the hiring committee right here. So it sounds like Zachary's novel, at least, emerged from a long journey as a debut author. Madeline, did you encounter any obstacles to publication? Did you have like a Scylla and Charybdis that you had to navigate your way through? And I want to hear more about your journey as well, but why don't we start with Madeline?
I was interested in you talking about the sort of building up and burning down. I also did that along the way, although it was not so joyful for me. It was more in the nature of, I have an entire novel finished, but I realized it's terrible and I'm throwing it out and starting again. So that was part of the journey. And actually it ended up taking me 10 years to write the whole thing, which is of course, you know, the length of the Trojan War, which was not intentional. But it does make me a little nervous to tackle the Odyssey because that is another 10-year journey. So I think it was just, I really wanted to, in approaching the Iliad, which is what I was looking at, although of course I was also drawing on some episodes in the Odyssey as well, I wanted to tell an epic story, the story that the Iliad tells, the story of the Trojan War, the story of Achilles. But I didn't want to use epic diction. I didn't want to use the epic voice. I wanted to come at it from another perspective. I wanted to come at it actually from the lyric voice. And in the ancient world, lyric poetry is sort of the opposite of epic poetry. It's the poetry of daily life. It's the poetry of love and friendship and sort of small things, dinner parties, you know, the guy you don't like who always comes over to your house and bothers you. It's just, you know, little things. And I wanted to use the lyric voice to tell the epic story. And I think it took me a long time to figure out that that's what I was doing. And then it took me longer to figure out how to do it. And so that was sort of the 10-year process.
And as you heard from her excerpt, Madeline's book has one of the best descriptions of falling in love I've read in a very long time. And I'd like that you captured just a little piece of that in what you read. Thank you. Scylla and Charybdis on your end?
Let's see. Well, it also took me 10 years to write, which is starting to seem kind of eerie. But and then with my decade done, my manuscript in hand, I tried to find representation, as one does, and got absolutely nowhere, like literally nowhere, like not even a rejection letter. as though black holes had swallowed all of the literary agencies in Lower Manhattan.
Charybdis.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. I started entering random contests, and I won one where her first prize was publication by a small press. And then nothing really happened, and then I thought I would try to do an end run around the obstacles to getting media if you're with a small press. So I had Trojan horses built by a prop designer. They were about yay high and yay wide. And had the book put in the belly and sent off to various review venues. So it turns out higher end props are expensive, so I only had 5 made. One of them, I think, is still in use as a candy holder at the New York Times book department. Anyway, it worked once. I got a really nice review from the LA Times, and I thought maybe this was the breakthrough, and then nothing happened. And then I entered yet more contests, and one of them was the New York Public Library Young Lions thing. And I found out I made the final, and I thought, oh, well, great, that's nice, but nobody's going to care. I'm going to go to New York, and it's going to be a card table with some Pepperidge Farm cookies and two people. And
I think that sounds nice.
Yeah, so it sounds very pleasant, but it's not going to do anything. But then like two or three agents a day started calling me up from zero ever, and things proceeded from there.
I feel like we need one of those Trojan horses at the USC campus, so if you can find one.
God, I'd love to get one of them, actually.
Or at least for the LA Times office, if they were so instrumental. In...
Oh, they have theirs.
Okay. All right. Well, then I'll
have one made for you.
Okay. I'm going to hold you to that. The podcast is our record of,
damn it,
of the contract. I want to repeat one line from Zachary's preface that you guys heard. This is what he writes. Despite its complexity, only a handful of images are central to the Odyssey, which is really true if you think about it. So which one of Homer's images or tropes did you have the most fun with?
The homecoming, I guess, is an obvious and extremely resonant scene.
Tell us about it.
I think it's easily identifiable. Coming back. Well, I mean, there's the idea of love and separation and home and all of these things brought up to some high power of intensity by circumstances.
I think I would say the episode of Achilles' rage, which I guess is also sort of a centerpiece of the Iliad. Achilles is enraged because, this is also a spoiler, his lover Patroclus has been killed, and he is just completely obliterated, shattered with rage and grief, and he goes out to kill the Trojan champion Hector. And one of the interesting things that has happened in the story up to that point is that Patroclus has gone out to fight dressed as Achilles to try and frighten off the Trojans because Achilles isn't fighting because he's sulking, because he's angry at Agamemnon, the head of the Greek forces. So Patroclus goes out wearing Achilles' armor, pretending to be him, and he's killed by Hector. And Hector strips the armor, as you can do if you have killed someone. It's your right to take it. It's not always nice, but it is your right. So he takes the armor. And so when Achilles fights Hector, Hector is actually wearing his armor. And Achilles has had to get new armor from his sea goddess mother. And I always feel like this is the moment where Achilles meets his fate, because there's been this prophecy that right after Hector dies, Achilles' death will follow sort of on the heels of that. And so here, Achilles literally faces himself and sort of comes to terms with his mortality. So I think that part.
Really well described. While we're on the subject of Patroclus, both books take on very unexpected points of view. And I'm wondering if this experimentation with voice was something deliberate, or if it took you guys a long time to come to these specific points of view.
I was always interested in approaching the book from lots of different angles. The Lost Books is sort of taking the Odyssey and shattering it and putting it back together in new ways. So variation in voice follows naturally.
So which voice did you most enjoy writing?
Oh, that's a good question. The Cyclops, probably. I like the monsters.
That one, I have to say, that's my favorite chapter.
Oh, good.
I think it's really beautiful. It's also about storytelling itself. It has the it positions the Cyclops as the storyteller, right? If I remember correctly?
Yeah. The Cyclops is blind and sitting in a cave and obsessed with Odysseus, and that sounded like a fair description of Homer.
So clever. I'm having a little moment of jealousy over the cleverness. it happens. Madeline, perspective and voice are so important to your novel, so I'm expecting an equally clever and beautiful response.
For me, it was Patroclus from the beginning. I really did not consider any other option. It was, you know, Patroclus or bust. From the moment I sat down and started writing it, I really wanted his voice. And I think it was because he is both completely central to the Iliad and also totally peripheral. He's a very small character. If you were casting it, you know, your name would be way, way, way down at the bottom. But at the same time, whenever Achilles is there, he's sort of lurking in the background. He doesn't have a lot of lines, but he's there. And Achilles, we spend sort of the whole Iliad hearing from Achilles that I'm never going to fight. Nothing's going to make me fight the Trojans. And, of course, Patroclus' death immediately launches him back into the war. And so I sort of felt like he's the hinge on which the whole Iliad turns. And who is he? Who is this man that Achilles is so in love with, so taken with, so absorbed by, that he can make him completely reverse his position? And one of the things that is a little bit tricky, as I've already spoiled now, is that Patroclus dies before the story is finished. He dies before Achilles dies. He dies before Troy falls, before all of that. And so there was some question at some point whether or not I was going to have Patroclus tell the whole thing, or whether or not I might kind of go off and give it to another narrator. Odysseus would be a possible choice. Odysseus, who sort of, you feel like Odysseus sees all. Or Achilles himself, or something like that. And I actually wrote a few end versions where I experimented with other characters' voices, and it was completely wrong. It felt completely wrong. I wanted to be Patroclus all the way through.
I'm recalling Achilles says briefly why he likes Patroclus so much in the beginning of the book, and he says just three words: "He is surprising." And it's just so, reveals so much, but also leaves so much to the imagination. Again, just such a great story of the human experience of falling in love. I love that. Okay. I guess we should talk a little bit about reading adaptations today. Obviously, you know, the Odyssey is a story of war. It's a story of wandering. But it takes place in a world that's so much smaller than our world today. Do you see parallels between Homer's universe and our world today, or do they just feel so far apart?
I think soldiers returning from war are always going to identify with the Odyssey. The Iliad is an interesting question. I mean, there's always been war, and there probably always will be, but it used to be a lot more personal. Mm. So somebody, I forget who, said that the nearest modern parallels of the warriors from the Iliad are not soldiers who are highly disciplined and in a wholly rigid hierarchy, but NBA players. So they're physically extremely prepossessing, and they're extraordinarily egotistical and rich and viciously competitive.
Wow. I hadn't thought that at all. That's fascinating. Yeah. NBA players.
No. And sometimes omit fine points of morality.
Never. The NBA? Wow. What do you think?
Well, I would agree with you absolutely about the soldier aspect, and I hear that one of the events is gonna touch on that's coming up. There's actually a wonderful... I guess he's a psychologist who works with veterans in Boston, which is my hometown, named Jonathan Shea, and he's written two books. One is called Achilles in Vietnam, and the other is called Odysseus in America. And it's him talking about his experience in sort of reading the classics with these veterans, and how much resonance there really is. And so certainly that aspect I would absolutely agree with. And I think that, as I said, these are sort of timeless stories. I mean, yes, the small aspects have changed. You know, we go to war in a very different way than they went to war. But we do still go to war, and we do still suffer and grieve and lose people that we care about. And so I think that aspect is always relevant. And of course, the Iliad, it's always interesting to read the two together, because I find the Iliad a much more cynical piece in many ways than the Odyssey is. I think it's because of the sort of, it's all about kind of corrupt leadership. Agamemnon is the ultimate example of a corrupt leader. Everything he does for himself. He never does anything for the good of the army, even though he's constantly pressing that button to try and get other people to do things. So it's this poem about sort of feeling completely alienated from the power structure. And what happens when Achilles kind of tries to teach the power structure a lesson. The fight crystallizes around Achilles and Agamemnon, but what you really see, and this is kind of, Alice Oswald is going to come in and talk about this, is the people who die because of this fight between Agamemnon and Achilles are the common soldiers and the common people. These are the people who suffer because of this squabble that's going on in the upper echelons. So I think that is also interesting, too.
Absolutely. It's really wonderful to be reminded of the use value of these ancient stories, that they keep getting reinvented, but also have so much to say about the way we live today. That seems wonderful. Well, I think it's time to hand it over to you guys, if there are any audience questions.
Hi, is this working?
Yeah, go right.
Okay, great conversation. So you both had the privilege to spend 10 years with your characters and sort of think about what it was like to get into their psyches and try to understand them a little bit more. So I'm curious to know what your feelings are about the gods. Who are the gods from the 21st century perspective? Are they these sort of amorphous forces in the universe, or are they sort of slivers of the characters' psyches? How did you come to understand the roles that the gods play in the in moving the actions of these stories?
So something I really like about Homer is that you can read it both ways. You can read the gods as a manifestation of universal human impulses or the characters' psyches or what have you. Or you can read them as these powerful noumens who are exerting agency on the world. And it feels almost like the subtle postmodern conceit, the lack of commitment there.
I agree. I think you can read it both ways, and I think people have, as they've interpreted Homer, you have definitely had people go the way that, you know, the gods are just these psychological manifestations. There are gods in my book, because Achilles' mother is a goddess, and I really wanted to keep that aspect because I felt like it was really core to the Iliad and to who Achilles is, that he is trapped between the divine and the human. But how I came to understood that, I really wanted to tap into the cruelty of the ancient Greek gods. They truly are completely self-absorbed, totally passionate about what they want, very uncompromising, very unforgiving, and very frightening to be around. And I wanted all of that to be activated. And I think as I was sort of creating that, you know, I saw Achilles as being caught, as I said, between the divine and the human. But Achilles' son, whose name is Pyrrhus or Neoptolemus, in my book is raised exclusively by Thetis, exclusively by a goddess. He lives with her under the sea. He eats the food of the gods. And so what I really enjoyed was imagining what a human would be like who had grown up with these creatures, with these totally unfeeling, all-feeling, inhuman beings. And the answer that I came up with is a total sociopath.
So, among the gods, I always thought Athena was the most interesting. Mm-hmm. It feels like the others are just these savage, omnipotent animals who happen to be capable of language, but Athena feels like she's capable of reflection and is of a slightly different order. I'm not sure this is really justified in the text, and or as opposed to how I remember it many years since reading the Iliad, but it's sort of there for me.
I think I also, talking about the Odyssey, I also like characters who occupy the space in between. So for example, Circe, the witch, She is divine. She's the daughter of Helios, the god of the sun. But she is, the gods are sort of a little afraid of her. She's a little bit outside. She has this power over herbs. She has a power over spells. It's different from divine powers, but she's definitely... So I think those figures are also really interesting, too, the ones who are kind of at the margins of the gods, who don't really fit into divinities, but neither do they fit into humans.
If you read an English version of the Odyssey or the Iliad, do you have a preferred translator?
So I think it's really depends on personal taste. There are a lot of wonderful ones out there, and I would suggest going to a bookstore. I hear there are some wonderful independent bookstores here in the area. And reading a couple different ones, reading a sample from a couple of them and seeing if one speaks to you. The good news is I think Homer goes very well into English. I feel like there's something about the Homeric line that just comes into English really nicely. So you're not going to go horribly wrong with any of the ones that are out there. I think Fagles is a tried and true. I also like Lombardo. I think he captures sort of it's much more modern, much less literal, but there's a verve to it, I think, that captures the Homeric energy. But there are people who will passionately disagree with me on both of those points, so I think it's personal taste.
I actually haven't read the Odyssey since I was 12. Nobody believes me, but it's true.
I would say, however, the audio version is wonderful. That you were talking before about how these are oral poems, and I think that they can still be experienced really wonderfully out loud. I don't know who the reader is for the Odyssey, but the Fagles has Derek Jacobi for the Iliad, so you can't. Oh, it's Ian McKellen, so you can't go wrong.
Question's really for Madeline, though I'd be happy to hear from both of you. When Achilles, after his rage and horrible actions, succumbs to Priam's visit, what's going on in this sociopath? I mean, I've wondered about that for decades, but I'd love to hear what your opinion is.
I think that is something also that Homer leaves open. I think he doesn't give us one answer. I think he gives us many answers, and we can sort of read ourselves into that moment. I think what Priam does really beautifully is Priam throws himself on Achilles' humanity. Here he is. He's an aged man. He's the king of Troy, but he's come into Achilles' camp completely alone. He's, you know, gone through the river. He's gone past the Greek guards, could have easily been killed. And yet here he's come alone, one man to another, saying, I know that you're sad. You know, I know that you've lost someone. I've lost someone too. And I feel like that is what makes that moment so powerful, is that they sort of meet not as enemies, not as warriors, but as humans.
Next question. I'd like to say first that I love both these novels. And I think the fact that two such different novels could be created out of what are essentially dead texts is proof, not just that Homer is a genius, but that both of you are. So I'm so delighted to be in a room with both of you. I want to return to a question that Molly asked earlier and say, I'm here with my students. We're all Trojans, the destined reign of Troy, and we're about to rebuild Troy in Barstow. So anyone who wants to join us, we're reading the Aeneid now. And if either of you wants to write a novel about the Aeneid, you're welcome to come to our class. But what struck me in listening to both of you talk and thinking about the two books is that when I started teaching a great books class, I chose the Odyssey because it seemed to me, as someone who writes on the 19th century novel, to be the more novelistic. It's more psychological. You get a really deep sense of the characters. And there's a profound way in which, unlike the Iliad, just about everybody is likable, that you feel that you're inside them, that there's this diversity of point of view. And I think it's not an accident that people have argued only half jokingly that the Iliad was written by a man and that the Odyssey was written by a woman, that there were two Homers. I like to think of them as a married couple bickering at night over whose epic is better. And yet both of you in some ways turned against those traditions. That is, Ms. Miller, you really psychologized something and in a sense romanticized something that the Iliad deliberately left unsaid. In the same way, Mr. Mason, that you just shattered the unity, the great narrative impulse, that drive to go home that is at the heart of the Odyssey. Did you have a sense of rebelling? Did you have a sense that Homer would be on your side? Did you have a sense that he was a little anxious? Did you ever want to talk to him and ask him what he thought of what you were doing? How do you think he would read your books? And if we were in this room, would he be asking for your autograph or asking for copyright? Or would he be standing out there with a little sign saying, don't read these books. Books are bad.
Thank you. So I felt like what I did was almost already there. Like, Odysseus tells part of the Odyssey, and he's a famously unreliable narrator, and he seems to take great pleasure in deceiving people just for fun, really, to showcase his verbal and almost his literary virtuosity. So it seems like you just need to give it a little bit of a push, and the entire thing comes apart, and it's just lies within lies in this sort of vortex of misdirections. Now, I don't feel like I was doing violence to the book, although, yeah.
Well, and the Odyssey is actually, although there is a real unity of the desire to go home, it's also very episodic, and I feel like that's part of its nature as well. That, you know, there's a Cyclops episode and the episode with Circe, and so part of, you know, it is kind of short story, fragmentary, in a sense also. I also feel like I was doing something that was already there, which was that, for me, you know, the Iliad tells us what it's about in that first amazing line, sing goddess of the destructive rage of Achilles. And that is the narrative through arc. Why is Achilles so angry? And I sort of feel like that there was a little bit of a mystery there, because the way that anger is presented, it's presented in the context of his fight with Agamemnon, the leader of the Greek forces, over sort of who's in charge, does Achilles have to do what Agamemnon says, you know, and that fight. But that as the poem continues and we come into the Patroclus episode, that anger is completely transformed and it becomes an anger towards Hector. And then in the episode with Priam, he finds a way to let go of his anger. And so it really actually forms this wonderful arc already of Achilles dealing with his anger and then the closure of him being able to let it go, and how that anger changes over the course of the poem. So I sort of felt like that was the through line I was following. I was trying to hold on to that and then bring all the stuff that I sort of feel like is already there, but just bring it to the surface. So I hope Homer, if he or she existed, would not mind.
This is for Zachary Mason. You mentioned a failure or with mathematics and literature, or your early interest in that and how you felt it sort of waned. And I just thought I'd make the observation that with all these different threads through the narrative, what is emerging is a hypertextual Homer. Mm-hmm. And that is, you may not have burned down the idea as completely as you thought you had initially.
Well, perhaps it would be most accurate to say I reduced the dimensionality. Like, it was originally the entire volume of the text, and now it's a sort of lattice going through it. Like, you're right, the book does have a hypertextual structure. There are lots of more and less subtle connections between the chapters, if you look carefully. So, yeah, well observed.
This question is for Mr. Mason. You said you hadn't read the Odyssey since you were 12, so I was wondering why you didn't revisit it in writing your novel, like before or during.
That would have been the sane thing to do, but I actually thought about it. My idea was that I wasn't trying to imitate Homer's voice or write some sort of English pseudo-epic. I was trying to work with the essence of the poem. And it seemed like a great way to do that was to see what was still in my mind when I hadn't read the book for almost a quarter century. Which, you know, I happened not to have read the book for a quarter century, so it was right there. I went back and reread it after the Lost Books came out, and I now and then would find things that I wished I'd included, but that had faded from my mind, like Argo the dog, who is fated to get to see his master once more, never makes an appearance. But that's awfully resonant, so I would have used that if I'd thought of it.
Well, that was epic. Thank you for coming. Get your book signed.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.